Hello, listener, and welcome to yet one more edition of the Zeitgeist Tapes, in which my co-host, Emma Burnell, who is a playwright, singer-songwriter, journalist, consultant. What don't you do, Emma?
I'm not very good at gardening.
Okay, don't ever go to her for gardening. My co-host, Emma Burnell, and myself, Stephen Fielding, who barely does one thing, so we won't go into that. We discuss aspects of culture, specifically works of fiction, drama, films, high and low culture, and talk about, knock around the potential politics of them, as well as making random gratuitous remarks about various actors and writers and what we think about them. Now, this week, we're going to talk about, in this edition, we're going to talk about the six-part BBC series Sherwood, which was aired recently and is still available on the iPlayer, maybe forever, who knows. And today we're joined, as we are wont to, by a guest. In this case, it's Professor Mark Steers, whose career has taken in Oxford and Sydney, and is now director of the University College Rights Lab, Policy Lab. Policy Lab. Right, Emma will edit that. It's just at Nottingham we have a Rights Lab, and it's just like right. Okay, I'll just start from. And today we're joined, as we are sometimes are, by a guest. In this case, Professor Mark Steers, who's career has taken in the University of Oxford and Sydney, and has also worked with Labour leader Ed Miliband, and has just recently been appointed to the University College Policy Lab. One of whose visiting professors is the playwright James Graham, who coincidentally enough wrote Sherwood. So, Mark, I just wonder if you could just for our listeners' benefit, what is the Policy Lab doing, and what are you doing with a visiting professor who's a playwright?
Thanks so much. Wonderful to be here and chatting to you both. So the point of the Policy Lab really is that academics, as I'm sure both of you are aware, have been incredibly frustrated over the last decade or so that their influence has not been what they would like it to be in our political life. They think that they have all kinds of analyses and ideas and policy proposals that somehow don't seem to get pick up from the government of the day or even from the opposition. And so that frustration, I think, has grown and grown from within universities, and is sort of met on the other side by a frustration, I think, by many community groups, civil society organizations, and some politicians that perhaps universities aren't pulling their weight in terms of coming up with new ideas for the common good rather than ideas for academic publication. So you've got frustrated academics wanting to be influential, and you've got a sort of broad section of society wanting to get more out of universities. And the point of an initiative like the Policy Lab is to try and bring those two communities together so that we can have sort of, hopefully exciting conversations about what university research might be able to bring to our political life to improve policy options on the table. So that's what we kind of do. I think the starting admission really has got to be that the status quo doesn't get us there, that like the way that universities are currently run doesn't do it, the way that politics is currently run doesn't do it. And so you need to try and shake things up. And that was the idea really of approaching James Graham, which is, he's such a wonderful playwright, but also someone who manages to get people to think about political ideas that they otherwise wouldn't think about, and to open up sort of new bits of imagination and creativity. And we thought, well, if we get James on board to try and do that for some of our academics and some of the community groups that we work with, that might be to everyone's advantage.
And James, worth saying, obviously, that Mark did ask me first, but I just couldn't fit this into my busy schedule of singer, songwriting, playwriting. So they had to go for second best with James Gray.
Perhaps. Very probably, Emma. But I should also point out, in case and the listener thinks this, we've got some grudge against James Graham, that we've actually discussed James's work in the past, and James has been a guest as well.
Indeed, a huge fan of James. In fact, it was a dare by James that actually made my last play happen. So I'm a big fan.
So we're going to talk about Sherwood, and for the benefit of our listener, Sherwood is about, well, yes, that's the thing. We can actually discuss what it's actually about, but ostensibly, it's about a former pit village in Nottinghamshire, 40 years after the 1984-5 miners' strike, when there is, you know, no longer a pit to be having a strike over. And it's about the divisions in that pit village that continue decades after the actual strike. For the benefit of our listener who may not be middle-aged or elderly, Nottinghamshire was one of the parts of the National Union of Mine Workers which did not officially support the strike. Miners were divided over it, and there was a lot of bitterness between those that continued to work and those that were on strike. And the series kind of explores those continuing divisions as they're brought back to the surface. They haven't ever gone away, back to the surface by a series of murders which are assumed to be connected to those divisions, and in particular to the role of a spy cop from the Metropolitan Police who played a role in fingering some striking miners and getting them into trouble, and in the end being blacklisted by their employers when they went back to work. Mm. So it's about the present day and about how the past influences the present, but also specifically about the miners' strike and its consequences. So I don't know if that's a fair kind of summary of that, but Mark, I mean, as our guest, and I've been reading Nietzsche relatively recently because I'm pre-retired, so I can now read things that I've not read at all and probably should have done. And he obviously is famous for his notion of will to power. And I just wonder, you know, think about in Nietzschean terms, what would you say James's will to power was in writing this series? What did he want the viewers, how did he want to influence the viewers and shape their thinking?
I mean, I think that the overarching ambition that James had in the play, I'm sure there were many, but the biggest one is this sense that at the moment in Britain, it's as if we are unable to think about the future, and we're continuing to relitigate these rows of the past. And that's that was done in your brilliant setup there. You know, it's like 40 years ago since the miners' strike. Most of us should have forgotten it, even if we were alive during it. And yet the show shows just how it is still so palpable in those communities. And it's the thing that people talk about. It's what they chant on the football terraces. It's like people get their pints of beer spilled over them for being on the wrong side in the strike. And I think that's not just meant to show how intense the strike itself was, but that perhaps we've lost our collective ability to be able to think about futures rather than to just think about pasts. And when you've lost that capacity to be able to imagine what 10 years' time looks like or 20 years' time looks like, what you end up doing is not just being stuck in the present, but like going back and back and back and sort of living in those sort of weirdly nostalgic and sentimental bits where everyone knew whose side everyone else was on, and you sort of just stuck in those polarized arguments. And I think that's really what the show just brings that so powerfully to light, that whole lives are currently wasted by the looking back when we could be looking forwards. And that's a challenge to us all about what we ought to be able to do about that.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. There is definitely a really strong strain of nostalgia politics that permeates all sides of politics. And it's not even necessarily nostalgia for an era any of us lived through. I mean, I was alive during the miners' strike, but I was 9. I do have strong memories because my parents were very staunch socialists. So we did a lot of solidarity stuff from East London, where I grew up. But it wasn't divisive in our community in the ways that it was, particularly in Nottingham, where they did have the breakaway UDM. But I think that you just have to look at the way that we constantly hark back to the Second World War, which happened. People keep saying boomers. I'm like, boomers were literally born in the 50s. That's what the term comes from, the baby boom of the 1950s. They weren't alive in the war, and they are my parents' generation. yeah, there are fewer and fewer people who can remember the actual war, never mind actually served in it. Yet it's becoming, it feels like it's more powerful now in the collective imagination than it was 10, 20 years ago. And I, that sort of Disneyfication of history, where we just take this one sense of what it was and don't look at any of the nuance or interest, and that becomes easier and easier as it actually falls out of living memory, is, I think you're right, I think that is part of what James was looking at, was you know, that kind of very black and white reading of something that has clearly existed at the time, but is very much calcified in the 40 years since.
Emma, don't, by the way, knock the Second World War, mythologizing the Second World War. That's part of my brilliant career, that was. I don't know where I would have been without it. But anyway,
all I'm saying, Stephen, is that you bring the nuance to the Churchill discussion in your many books.
Well, to my two fellow authors do. But yeah, I mean, I wonder what the... I mean, the BBC... You know, the audience for drama on BBC One is probably a bit elderly. I mean, people that would have probably remembered at least bits of the miners' strike themselves. But clearly, James was, you know, conscious of the fact that some people wouldn't really know at least some of the details, or indeed most of the details, because there's a bit of exposition at various points where characters actually explain what the hell happened. And usually, I mean, and there is an intergenerational thing that he does bring out. And in fact, it's quite important, the intergenerational thing, because in the village itself, there are sisters there, and just outside the village, you know, there are brothers and there's others who, you know, the division between the working and the striking miners continues and has had its repercussions in family life in all kinds of different ways. But then there's the younger generation, and, you know, there's like the Romeo and Juliet couple, who are like the granddaughter and the grandson of people that were involved directly in the strike, for whom it means nothing. But then there's the character of Scott, the one that goes on, you know, he's the kind of vaguely Robin Hood character, if only because he's killing people with arrows.
Bow and arrow.
Yeah. That everybody assumes, as he's going on killing these people, it's got to have something to do with the miners' strike. It has to have something to do with the miners' strike. And they kind of read off on that. And when they finally get him, I mean, spoiler alert, listener, but, you know, come on.
We always do spoiler alerts on this show.
And then when they finally get him, they realise it was, I mean, not directly anything to do with the miners' strike. And yet... it was, because, I mean, he literally calls himself, you know, he says, well, I'm nobody now. Who am I? I'm just, and I don't know if James is kind of underlining it just a little bit too much, but he literally says, I'm white, working class man, and I'm nothing, you know, basically. And the reason why he was going around killing people was to prove, at least to himself and to everybody else, he was somebody. Yeah. So, yeah, sorry, Mark.
No, I think that's really important. I mean, in chatting to James a little bit about this kind of theme, he has this amazingly powerful sentence when he says, like, people who are from villages like that, which, you know, includes himself, because that's where he was brought up, are told all the time that you are from a former mining village or from a former pit village. And he says, like, just like, think of what the psychology of that means. It's like, you know, everything of value is in the past. Everything of value is lost. And you have to get your definition from, you know, either the nostalgia that Emma was talking about, or from that sense of alienation and sort of left behindness that is so much part of the sort of, you know, right-wing politics of the present. And that's kind of, I think, what Sherwood is a sort of rail against. It's like if you define everything by reference back to what these places like this used to be, and the struggles that they used to see, then there's just nothing left. And more than that, that when you try and make sense of the present through the lens of the past, you're stuck in that mad conspiracy thinking, you know, where you think, well, everything must have something to do with the miners' strike. And it doesn't have anything to do with the miners' strike. And that's the sort of big reveal at the end of the show. It's like, you know, no, like, we've got to leave that behind. We've got to be able to think about a way of creating something, you know, bolder and more positive for communities like this. And it's just, you know, kind of very straightforwardly, it's just not fair on a new generation to cast their whole lives in terms of, you know, what these communities used to be, the injustices that they used to suffer, and the sort of losses that they've endured. You've got to be able to give people something, you know, sort of much more forward-looking than that if they're going to thrive.
I think that's really true. And I think that was the most, for me, definitely the most powerful part of the whole thing was that that sense of definition of former. And whether that was a former pride or a former shame or a former division or a former unity, it was all former. All of them, whichever side of that they fell on, were defining themselves by the past, and passing on those definitions to the next generation in ways that just baffled them in many ways. You know, there was a lot of discussion of, there was an online kind of troll farm as part of the odd crime family / taxi firm had a troll farm as part of their criminal enterprise.
Yeah,
yes. And they, you know, that they did, the guy who, you know, said, "I'm nothing, I'm from nowhere." Part of that was this sense that where he was from was the internet. And that's where he'd been empowered as this sort of nothing and nowhere man. You know, that's where your lone white guys can turn to be empowered in very dangerous ways.
And that absence of reality is really important. I mean, there's a really touching scene, I think, in when the spy cop, we discover who the spy cop is, and she turns out to have married this sort of local gangster, and they're sort of, you know, generally up to no good. But they also try to have these, you know, very touching romantic visions of their future, you know, what they might be able to do when their kids are old enough to have left home, and, you know, with the money that they've made in various dastardly ways. And it's actually really sweet, their sort of ambitions for what they can achieve. But of course, they're hauled back into the past by the realities of how she got to be in the community in the first place, and, you know, the lives that they lived and the various betrayals that have been made. And that, again, I think takes us to that real, you know, sort of powerful driving sense of the show, which is like how can we, you know, leave behind some things that we've done wrong as a country and as a society in order to be able to achieve the things that we want to be able to achieve, which include, you know, sort of romantic family life.
Yeah, that's, I mean that's Philip Jackson. I've got to put in a word for Philip Jackson, because one of the things this benefits from is the cast. I mean, there's obviously a bit ridiculously good, but I mean, Philip Jackson, if this is my only opportunity in history to say what a great actor Philip Jackson is, he can do anything. He can do, but he's playing as the badass head of the Sparrow family, you know. And as Mark, you were saying, there's that touching moment when he comes over with a mug of tea talking to his wife, who's hurling axes because she knows she's about to be exposed to the spy cop, and he's talking romantic about going away on a caravan. It's really sweet. But Emma, you were about to say something.
Well, I was going to say that my own, I suppose, trap of the past is that my biggest bugbear with the show, which overall I really enjoyed, was that I felt they soft-pedaled the spy cop storyline way too much.
Because
in the end she married for love and stays with the guy that she loves, and she loves him, and actually an awful lot of the spy cop story is that they married these poor women, and it's usually not a woman doing it, spoiler alert, it was a woman in this one. It's a bloke marrying some woman, having children with her, and then turns out has a whole nother life over, you know, 20 years on the go somewhere else, never actually had romantic feelings for them at all. Or if they did, were, you know, very compartmentalized. And that felt to me a little bit, the thing that flashed up at the beginning to explain what spy cops were, and they were like in the 70s and 80s, and I'm like, and the 90s and noughties at least, and probably still going on. But we certainly know it was going on in those times, because there was a huge, huge scandal about it in about 2011, 2012, where a number of green activists found that they'd been having long-term relationships with people who weren't who they said they were. So I did feel that the idea that actually it was all love, really, I know that's the sensibility that we were going for in the show, and that love and conciliation is important and all that. But it felt to me, because that was happening in that storyline, it felt soft-pedaled a bit.
Well, I mean, there are some aspects of it that I wondered about that actually do probably follow on from that. I mean, obviously, I presume he decided to make the spy cop a woman would make the spy cop more sympathetic. I mean, I guess. And the object was, there were no bad guys, right? There were no bad guys in this, were there? Even the bad guys weren't the bad guys. The sparrows were lovable rogues. They were selling class A drugs to the local community. They were lovable rogues.
The bloke who smacked his daughter-in-law around the head just because she was a bit annoying is probably a bit of a bad guy.
But he didn't really mean it, did he? I mean, he was a bit, you know, he wasn't a bad person. He wasn't an act done in mouth. Anyway, but maybe you found a little hole in my argument. Let's just go over that. But broadly, there weren't really any bad guys. And I noticed, and it does go back to the spy cops thing about what you were saying, that there are some references to they. Right. Like when, certainly in the last episode, when, you know, different parts of the community are all coming together, all trying to work out what the impact of, you know, the horribleness that was going on and what it all means, and what and the wife of the first victim says, in the cold light of day, none of that old stuff seems to matter anymore. You know, that she'd been 30 years or so not talking to her sister, and now it doesn't matter anymore. But who's to blame for this? And it's them. I mean, directly said. And that might be the sense in working class communities such as that. I don't know. But Ian St. Clair, the police superintendent, whatever his rank was, he's found out who the actual spy cops is. And he says, you know, and he's saying to the woman, you're not to blame. They made you do it. They put me in a uniform, and then he kind of dropped his father in it, and then he ends up going to prison after a NUM kind of a thing. And one of the other characters says, we should forget about these differences. That's what they want. They want us to continue to be like this. And there's a kind, I mean, I just wondered, I know he's not intending to sound conspiratorial, but who are the they? Who are the them? Who are these deus ex machinas who are doing bad things that are manipulating these people? Or is that just, he's trying to find a dramatic way?
I think that's a really important challenge. I mean, sort of trying to ventriloquize James Graham a bit. I think the argument is basically that there are, and Emma's made it really well, you know, there are good people in surprising places. That's fundamentally the important piece.
Yes.
Like, even the bad guys are not that bad in their sort of human heart of hearts. That's an important part of his overall message, I think. But that we are confronted with, you know, unfairnesses, injustices, you know, sort of evil, and that must have its cause somewhere. And as you say, in a way, we just don't know precisely where that, you know, what the cause is. Is it some sort of, you know, genuinely evil person who's off screen? Or is it sort of a kind of structural phenomenon? This is like the, you know, Miliband Palantzis debate from the 70s about, you know, is capitalism like, you know, a driving force, or are there evil capitalists pulling levers? And I kind of think that probably what James Graham thinks is, you know, life is lived by fundamentally decent people in circumstances not of their own making, which often lead them to do things that they shouldn't do and that they bitterly regret and they can't find their way out of. And the, you know, the kind of call to arms is for all of us to try to stare that reality in the face and just to recognize that ultimately let's stop the blame game of looking for the nasty individual and sort of casting them as the problem, because actually most of them aren't the problem, that the problem is structural instead, and that requires a sort of bigger sort of, you know, vision or sort of imaginative boldness in order to be able to grapple with it. So, you know, so perhaps Mrs. Thatcher was evil, you know, she's like left out of the story, but essentially the characters in Sherwood, you know, came of age at a time when they found themselves propelled into social arguments that they should never have been propelled into. And the kind of message for us now is like, let's stop with the looking for scapegoats and looking for people to throw sort of rocks at, and let's start recognizing that many of the challenges that we face are just bigger than any individual, and they're going to require us to have to up our game if we're going to do anything about them.
But as a historian, still a historian, I mean, the series starts off with real actual clips of this Arthur Scargill, Thatcher, blah, blah, you know, the things that, you know, people like us would be familiar with about the strike. And it ends at the very end. It ends with the mine, clips of the miners going back and, you know, so the, all the pits being blown up and whatever. So those are real events. And obviously it's a dramatised version of how people responded to all that. And maybe a suggestion as to how they can transcend those differences. But there's no line in this. There's no, the miners' strike was about something very specific and real. And, you know, some people you could say were to blame. At that sort of meta level, you know, Thatcher for wanting to take on the miners, Scargill for wanting to turn it into a political strike and forcing those Nottinghamshire miners into a position they didn't want to accept, you know, they didn't want to accept going on a strike that hadn't been called nationally and all of that. But the series, while it allows the different sides to vent their views, I mean, there's a perfectly reasonable defence of why the miners who continue to work. There's a perfectly reasonable defence about why the miners who struck went unstruck and picketed those that wanted to continue working. But it's kind of like, you know, there's a kind of cordon sanitaire around the actual, real, historic reasons for it. So I don't know if that's a problem or that at all,
I think that's a really well-made challenge. I think James Graham's response would be, often people don't see, you know, even the people that we think really must see, you know, why they're doing the things that they're doing and why those things are really bad. So just to give you a more modern example, I had a conversation with him about COVID. You know, he was really, as people probably remember, he was an incredible activist in the early, you know, months of the pandemic,
trying to keep
the creative arts alive. And I think he didn't think that anyone was trying to close down theatres or put actors out of work. He just thought they hadn't seen it. Like they were so seized with the public health issue or the economic issues or the headline that they were failing to notice that, you know, this whole industry was collapsing. But more importantly than that for him, common spaces were collapsing. And that's the one of the themes in Sherwood too, is unless you have somewhere to go where you meet other people, you can't work through your, you know, your animosities. And like, there's this desperate sense in Sherwood that there's only, you know, there's one bar that everybody goes to, you know, sort of, you know, working person's club.
Yeah.
And some people are welcome and other people aren't welcome. And that because there isn't that common space, you can't work through your problems collectively. But it's not that anyone intentionally closed down those spaces. It's just that you know, the way that the economy has developed and society has developed is they've disappeared. And we've not attended to that disappearance. And I think that was James Graham's big argument during COVID. It's like, you know, of course we had lockdowns for good reason, but the consequence was people weren't meeting anymore. And when people don't meet, they can't overcome their differences of opinion. They can't build community spirit. And so he's like trying to grab us by the shoulders, I always think, and say, look at these things which are happening, not because anyone is intending them to happen, but because, you know, there's a kind of drift in that direction. And unless we do something about it consciously, you know, really take a stand, it's going to get worse and worse. And that's, I think, the overall thrust of Sherwood, really, is like, let's stop looking for blame, stop looking for the bad guys, start recognizing what's actually happening and do something about it.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Watching Sherwood made me slightly revisit Pride, which a film I absolutely adore. And I was thinking about it, and one of my latter responses to Pride, my initial response was pure emotion, was to think of the two communities, working class village communities in the UK and the LGBT community in the UK, one of those has done a lot better than the other. And it's always, always the economics that we overlook for everything else that's more immediate. And it just struck me really hard in this, that in so many ways, what James is doing is putting those economics first and saying, you know, whether these consequences were the evil intention or whether they were just the overlooking of the obvious outcome of removing a whole industry without thinking about what you put in its place or without thinking that government has a role of putting something in its place. This is what's happened. And this is what's happened because of the economy, not because of these people who they are socially. They are people who you would expect, particularly modern Tories, so lower working, lower middle to working class white folk, as it were, living in places that are largely Tory voting these days. And they are those communities that kind of, you know, got left behind, not just economically and social, but we focus on their social behaviour. Oh, have you bastards, why did you vote for Brexit? Or God, you're all racist bastards, aren't you? I said bastards a lot, but and I don't mean it. I'm saying that's the caricature that we have of them. But what we never think is, oh my God, we've screwed you economically for half a century now, at least. Why on earth aren't you more angry?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Rob Ford, the political scientist, puts it like this. He says, like, there are too many sort of well-meaning Labour activists who still sort of get on a bus and go into a working class community, knock on the door and say, hello, you're a bigot, vote Labour, you know, and it just doesn't work. And in a way, I think that's what James Graham is doing in the play, is to show that there is the warmth and humanity and creativity and decency in every single part of these divided communities. And it's screwed up and messed up. Because, you know, the circumstances which would enable it to get over those problems just, you know, aren't available. And that's all of our fault. You know, that's maybe some individuals more blame. You know, for a historian, you might be able to trace the causal link back to some people rather than others. But for those of us who are living right now, thinking about the future, the job is to say, all right, what do we need to put into place in order for these communities to work, you know, more successfully, collectively, you know, with common spirit?
And that's, I mean, that leads me to maybe the final sort of question or thing to talk about as you know, to draw this discussion to a gradual, gentle and very sophisticated close, which is that I can see, I totally agree, you know, this, what James is trying to do, what he's trying to pose in the way that we've said it. But I just thought the end was, and I say this, you know, with the greatest respect, just a little bit glib, in the sense that, I mean, one of the characters says, as after all the events have happened, and, you know, this is actually the Met officer who's got a guilty conscience and all his life never really was the same ever again, due to the events of the strike that he's associated with. And it's all over now. And he's much better. He's feeling much better about everything. And he says, it's like a spell has been broken. Right. And it ends literally with two brothers that had been alienated from another, what, knocking on the door, I've got some beers, oh, let's have a chat. Two sisters who've been, you know, divided, even though they lived only a few doors down from each other, you know, having a cup of tea or something, having a chat as if something had never, you know, it's just like, I understand, right, the problem and the aspiration, but the mechanism and the agency through which these divisions are going to be properly overcome in those very particular sort of relations. It was like, we need to know, we need another episode, you know, how does that actually happen? It's all very well going, well, this is kind of now going to happen, isn't it? But that's where the difficult stuff happens, isn't it? I don't know what you thought.
No, totally. I mean, reading people's Twitter feeds is probably never the best guide to anything. But
I did actually, not mine.
But following James's tweets during when Sherwood was being shown was, I think, really instructive. That the scene which seemed to mean most to him was slightly earlier in the show, when the two sisters can't bring themselves to talk to each other, and there's a really
they're touching the wall.
Exactly, yeah, they're separated by the wall, and the Leslie Manville characters touching the wall, you know, just in agony at the inability to reach her sister on the other side. And I remember James tweeting about that scene, you know, and just, and you could see that in a way, I think that's where he thinks the country is right now. Like, we're actually not in that final episode. We're in that middle episode where good people are divided, you know, in part by their inability to think about the future, and in part because there are no institutions or practices which are bringing them together to enable them to break those walls down. And that I think, if I was taking one thing away from Sherwood, it would be that scene, really, which is, you know, it doesn't do any of us any good to be divided in that way by those kinds of walls, but they are bloody hard to break, and working out what it's going to do to break them is, you know, what everybody who takes the issue seriously really needs to be spending their time thinking about.
And I think it's taking a community that still has pain. I think that pain is really important. And I think the depiction of that pain was really well done. And particularly through those two female characters. And I think we need to remember that pain makes us act quite irrationally and quite self-centeredly at times as individuals. And as such, that psychological approach and understanding that we're dealing with fellow human beings in pain, even when they're in pain over things that we're really positive about, perhaps, or vice versa, that has to be an understanding point. Because if we don't start from there, we won't ever understand the terrain we're actually on.
Okay, well, on that note, on that qualifiedly positive note, I think we should draw the discussion to an end. So thanks, Emma, as always. And also to Mark, who I should remind the listener of, because you should know this already, but his latest book, Out of the Ordinary, discusses some of these themes in relation to a variety of authors, photographers, artists of different sorts, and I recommend it very, very, very strongly. So thank you for contributing to the discussion, Mark.
Thanks so much.
And in my capacity as the alternating chair, I need to thank Lord Stuart Wood for the theme tune. I need to remind you this is a Political Human production, and that please, listener, if you haven't already, and why the hell haven't you, please rate and review this podcast on whatever platform you happen to find yourself on.